Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Today, I'm sitting down with Rory Jackson, who is a CCP and a midwife as well here in Queensland. So I'm only going to introduce him a little bit because I'm going to get him to introduce himself because he has a pretty cool story. So Rory, thank you for joining us today. We're going to chat about obstetrics and I guess a midwife's guide for paramedics to physiological birth. So, would you like to introduce yourself a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Thank you very much for having me. It's always a pleasure to come and chat with students and paramedics that are up and coming. So, for me, like you said, I'm a critical care paramedic and I've been working with the Queensland Ambulance Service for 14 or 15 years now. And I've been a critical care paramedic since 2012. I've also worked as a flight paramedic for about 4 years with from the helicopter base in Brisbane and also Toowoomba. And I worked in London for a year. So I went over there to give that a go and just to get a little bit more experience. And during my time as a paramedic, I have been lucky enough to deliver quite a few babies. So I decided that I'd go and study midwifery so that I could develop that skill set and my knowledge base, because I know it's an area that we don't tend to enjoy too much just through lack of knowledge and being a little bit avoidant. So I want to try and use my passion for midwifery and obstetric care plus being a paramedic to try and bring all of that together and share my knowledge and experience with paramedics throughout the country.
That's awesome. Well, it's been pretty cool to learn off you at university, having that dual background. So it's been cool to learn from you about that. Now, birth is something, I guess, that we don't tend to go to commonly in pre-hospital environment compared to, falls and cardiac chest pain, things like that. And we guess we don't learn it so for a long period of time at uni. Like you said, we do it for a short period of time. So I guess between learning the content and then actually going out and, helping deliver a baby might be quite some time. In that, you've mentioned in class, things that we have in a pre-hospital environment is more of a medical sort of paternalistic approach to obstetric care, particularly birthing. I guess, like you said before, about that lack of knowledge that we have towards it, and it can be considered amongst paramedics as a bit of a health emergency. And you debunked that pretty quickly in class, saying this is the type of approach we need to take, and you explain that. Do you want to explain that to our listeners today?
Yeah, sure. So, you're right. Birth and pregnancy related incidents don't account for a lot of our everyday work. So we consider them usually as paramedics. I think we all sort of think of them as being low frequency with high risk events. And what we need to realize, and my sort of mantra is, it's not an emergency until it is. And the majority of pregnancies do get to term without too many incidents along the way. And particularly when we see them, there is a lot more stress because we don't have a lot of information. And usually the woman or the family, they might be in a bit of panic or be in the middle of labor. So they're not able to share that knowledge that they have about their pregnancy with us very well. And then also when we look at our training as paramedics, usually a university degree will probably allocate 6 weeks as a minimum to any sort of obstetric related training or education. And that's usually in the third year of training. There are some degrees that offer a little bit more, which is great, but still I think the training that we get for the expectation that's placed on us as paramedics is quite low. So, if we can start going out and trying to educate ourselves as paramedics and as registered professionals, we'll be able to provide better care to these women and families and be able to feel a little bit more engaged with those jobs that we go to, which are quite low frequency. When it comes to that sort of emergency ideal that we place with the pregnancy or labour, it is difficult to take that away because we're trained to be emergency medical practitioners in the pre-hospital setting. So it's difficult for us, especially when we're a little bit stressed, to be able to go into that situation and treat the woman as a non-emergency and be able to gather all the information and provide the care that she requires and that we need to give. And usually that adds a lot of anxiety and stress, and that comes through in the care that we give. And we spoke, you know, in class, and also I've spoken to you about some of the research that's been done that talks about the experiences of women who have unplanned out of hospital births. And the evidence is pretty sad in some of the care that gets provided. Now, that's not everybody, but I think as a whole, we can definitely improve in that space as paramedics to try and provide better care. And to do that, I think it's just through education, because we can't increase our exposure. It's difficult to get time in birth suites to be able to see more births as paramedics, and we can't plan when we're going to see a birth. Some people might not ever see a birth in their career. Some people, like myself, I've been to 23. You know, I guess I consider myself lucky, but to some people, that's their worst nightmare. So it's difficult. So through knowledge, hopefully we can boost the experience that we provide to those women. And with that paternalistic approach that we have sometimes, I think as paramedics, we often do that as a fallback mechanism. So when we get called, usually it is for an emergency, and we usually, you know, historically we provide care that we think needs to be provided. But I think we should look at shifting that a little bit into providing a patient-centered care where they are the boss of their own healthcare, and listening to the patient and providing opportunity for information sharing, and providing the clear plan of what we're going to do and why we're going to do it, and allowing them, particularly when it comes to pregnancy, labor, or birth, allowing them the opportunity to decide with us rather than us just doing it to them.
No, you bring up a very good point in terms of person-centered care, and that research that you were talking about, that was quite interesting to read, and I'll pop it into the show notes, but it went into quite a bit of depth about how a woman's experience of birthing is quite multifaceted. So their experience of the birth, you know, can play quite a role in how they view themselves after that birth as well, and how they engage with their child. And I thought that was a really interesting point. And a lot of the points that were brought up about, you know, paramedic care was just basic things like respect and consent, and trust and communication. So it was quite interesting reading that, and it was a bit of an eye-opener as a student. So I guess in that sense, what is your guide to a physiological birth when you arrive on scene as a paramedic to the point where you're transporting?
That's a big question, but I'll try to break it down a little bit. So I think, you know, what I've learned from being a male midwife is that trust is everything. And we talk about basic cares often as paramedics, and that's, you know, what we're going to do. So the rest and reassurance and all of those types of things. I think that we could probably even change that terminology to trust building. So as paramedics, we're very good at building trust very quickly, and that comes down to communication. With labor and birth, I think communication is key. And so building that trusting environment not only is going to help from a physiological perspective to allow for a reduction in the adrenaline release from the woman, but also promoting oxytocin release, which is going to help with the labor progressing and moving forward, but also creating a trustful, safe environment is just really important for any birthing woman, because it's a really vulnerable time in their life. So my biggest piece of advice is using that communication skill that's, you know, for students is often just developing, but it comes down to every professional being able to create that trust through communication is really important. Then we need to recognize. So looking at the woman and trying to recognize at what point she is in the labor, very difficult for us as paramedics to do that because we can't do vaginal examinations to check on cervical dilation. But there's things that we can look at. So we can look at the way that she's presenting, if she's talking through her contractions or if she's going inside of herself during the contractions, how much pain that she's in with those contractions, the way that she's breathing, or if she's got any sort of grunting or pushing efforts. And if she's got that really strong, uncontrollable urge to push, or if there's any imminent signs of birth, we're probably moving into the second stage of labor. I know in your university and from teaching you, we spend a lot of time talking about transition. So transition from first stage to second stage. And usually that's evidenced by the way that the woman's presenting in terms of her emotional state. Sometimes they can become a little bit, I wouldn't say irrational, but they become very fearful or very vocal or very quiet, and their emotional and mental state changes a little bit. And that's a good indication that, you know, things are moving into the second stage and we're getting ready to start pushing. So using those things, plus your obvious signs of imminent birth, like bulging of the perineum, dilation of the anus, or if you can see labial parting, all of those things, we're going to obviously start setting up for a birth and probably not looking at transporting at that stage. Or if you're in the back of the ambulance, you might want to pull over now to prepare for a birth. The other thing that I think is really important is making sure that your environment's correct. So not only are you creating a safe and trusting and quiet environment, but you need to make sure you've got a nice warm environment and space for her to move. So you want the woman to choose a position that's appropriate for her, and that's up to her to decide. So promoting movement and encouraging movement is really important as a clinician. So either as a midwife or a paramedic or whoever is with the birthing woman, you know, giving her the permission, not that, you know, we need to give permission, but sometimes the encouragement to say, if you want to move onto all fours, or if you want to kneel, or if you want to squat, or if you want to stand, you know, facilitating that for her rather than keeping her on her back. And that's basically just to allow the baby to move through the pelvis and to promote descent of the baby and to open up that pelvic girdle as much as possible. And the woman will know intrinsically and instinctively what position she wants to be in. Then, you know, if we're getting to that point where, you know, we're starting to move into second stage, we can see the bulging of the perineum and all of those imminent signs of birth. We need to, with consent, probably start getting a little bit hands-on. So it depends on the different policies and procedures of different state guidelines for what is allowed and what isn't. But as long as that you're getting consent, it's important to try to control the delivery of the head. We want to do that to protect the perineum to avoid any catastrophic tears. And that usually they happen when we have an explosive birth. And what we want to do is to encourage pushing with contractions until we can see the head. When we start to have crowning of the head, so as the head's descending into the widest diameter, that's when we want to try and slow the pushing down. And usually the best way to do that is based on that trust and that communication. And you need to explain to her, hopefully earlier than when it starts happening, just trying to give a little bit of coaching, but ask her to do a small push and then breathe, and a small push, then breathe. If she's really not able to do that, you can get her to pant, or sometimes I say like blow out candles. So just little puffs of air, because it's very difficult to push explosively when you're doing that. And using your non-dominant hand on the baby's head to allow a little bit of counter pressure and flexion of the baby's head, that will just help as well to prevent the baby from having an explosive birth of the head. The birth of the shoulders, you know, again, depending on the guidelines of each different state, but in Queensland, we do promote a little bit of downward traction to promote the birth of that anterior shoulder. And once you can see the anterior shoulders, usually one or two pushes left, and then the baby's out. When I've been supervising or backing paramedics up for births, usually at the point that the baby is born is when everybody starts to sort of relax a little bit, but there's still a fair bit of work to do. So that work is we need to dry, warm and stimulate the baby, promote skin to skin contact, allow for delayed cord clamping, and again, getting consent for that and explaining why you want to do it is really important. Preparing your oxytocin injection. So depending on which drug you give, it's usually syntocinon, and we'll give that intramuscularly. And then clamping and cutting the cord after delayed cord clamping. And, you know, you can promote breastfeeding at that point. But keeping the baby really warm and skin to skin is important. And babies lose heat very rapidly in the pre-hospital setting. And usually that's probably one of the biggest complications we see with a normal physiological birth that's uncomplicated, is that we arrive with these very cold babies. So to keep them warm, we want to try and keep them wrapped with clean and dry wraps, but keeping the baby skin to skin, which means taking the mum's shirt off and actually having the baby skin to skin and keeping them that way. A lot of the paramedic midwives you see, we kind of have a bit of a pet hate of seeing paramedics getting their pictures taken with a baby that's just been born, because that time is really important for mother and baby to bond and to keep them skin to skin. So that's something, you know, it comes down to everybody's own practice, but you know, I think, you know, just be happy that you're able to be there to support the woman. We don't need photos, I don't think so anyway. And then the birth of the placenta. So, you know, obviously I'm talking about this in a very condensed version, but we want to make sure that we can birth that placenta, because it's not complete. The birth isn't complete. The placenta's out. And this is another thing that we see quite often, is that we're not birthing the placentas. And in the service in Queensland, we do promote controlled cord traction. So after the oxytocin and you've seen your signs of separation and some lengthening of the cord and a fresh shot of blood, guarding the uterus, very, very important. And then doing some controlled cord traction to deliver the placenta, and then fundal massage to ensure that the uterus is firm and contracted down. And that will decrease the rates of postpartum hemorrhage. So I guess in all of that, some key things would be to promote the safety and the communication and the trust with the woman and the family, recognizing when to stay and when to go, which is a really difficult thing. And I've been caught out several times as a paramedic, you know, even while I've been a midwife at the same time, I'm like, no, we've got plenty of time. And then, you know, we're 5 minutes into the trip, I'm like, oh, no, pull over, there's a head. So, you know, we just need to try to trust our instincts and listen to the woman, and just see what happens. You know, we can never be sure, but just try to make an educated decision of, you know, are we going to stay or are we going to go? And keeping the environment warm. And a little thing that I've always done is whenever I go to a house, if I think that we're going to be staying, I'll get them to put some dry towels into the clothes dryer if they have one, just so you've got some nice warm dry towels to put around the baby to dry and stimulate it. And just making sure we do little things like providing the woman with, you know, a sip of water or something, like she can have a drink, and it might just give her that little bit of reassurance that we're actually still looking after her. We're not just so focused on the actual birth. You know, she's still a person that we need to care for and really look after and promote that trust building, so that she can have a good experience. And then that controlled delivery of the head, and then promoting that nice warm environment for the baby after the baby's been born. And don't forget about the placenta. The placenta needs to come out. That would be my condensed version of a normal physiological birth.
Awesome. And so they were really great tips, and particularly don't take pics with the baby. But yeah. If things do happen to go wrong, and we won't go into all the different types because there's, you know, many different types of things and each state has their own protocols about handling those. But when something does go wrong, what goes through your head to try and, okay, bring a bit of a sense of calm back to the situation and not get overwhelmed with what's going on?
Yeah, and I think this is a good question for anything we do as paramedics. And as a critical care paramedic and, you know, somebody that's been around for a while now, my leadership style is all based on communication. And when I can feel my bandwidth getting small because I'm getting a little bit overloaded, or if I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do next, or if I'm trying to come up with a plan, I communicate it out. So whether or not that's talking to the patient or talking to the team, by doing that, you're making a statement, which is allowing other people to find their voice and say, no, that's not a good idea, or maybe we should consider doing something different. But it's also just making it very clear that everybody is aware of what's going on. in birth. I think it's really important that we do that. And by when you start to see things aren't going quite right, you know, communicating that with the woman and the family is really important. So, you know, let's, if we use the shoulder dystocia as an example, because it's probably one of the more common things that we might see in the pre-hospital setting that we need to be able to manage and recognize. So a way that you might communicate that out, because you're starting to get a bit stressed, to say, okay, well, you know, call the patient, whatever, Sam. Okay, Sam, so the baby's head has come out, but I'm noticing that the shoulders might be a little bit bigger than we expected. What we're going to have to do is a few maneuvers to try and help the baby come underneath your pelvic bone. The first thing we're going to do is we're going to lift your legs up really, really nice and wide to open up your pelvis. And then that way everybody in the room starts to recognize, okay, this is a shoulder dystocia. And, you know, if it's Alex, you know, you're there and you're in control, even if you're feeling really overwhelmed, you can start talking things out. The next thing we need to do is we need to put a bit of pressure just on your belly to try and rotate baby's shoulders a little bit. And then you might say, the next thing we need to do is deliver the baby's arm. And somebody else might say, oh, actually, can we try the Rubens 2 first? And then you go, oh, yeah, excellent. Thank you very much. Yeah, let's do that. So what I need to do, Sam, is I need to put two of my fingers inside of your vagina and try to push baby's shoulder over a little bit to move it away from the pelvic bone. And I find that when you can communicate clearly, or even not that clearly, like if you can just get the words out, you can start to calm yourself down and you can also start communicating your plan rather than just trying to do things to somebody that has no idea why you're doing them. And that becomes very confusing for any patient. Like, you know, if we have go to a patient who has, you know, broken their arm, but hasn't realized that it's compounded yet. And as a CCP, if I just get there and start putting cannulas in and then start drawing up the ketamine, becomes very scary for the patient plus the bystanders. Whereas if I arrive and say, okay, so-and-so, whatever your name might be, now you might not have noticed yet, but the bones come out the back of your arm. I don't want you to look at it, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you some medication. It's going to make you quite drowsy and you might go to sleep for a little while. While you're asleep, I'm going to wash it. You won't feel anything and I'll put the bone back into place and we'll splint it. And when you wake up, we'll give you some better pain relief and we'll make sure that you're comfortable. Is that okay with you? And if they say no, you say, well, it's very important, you know, that, and you start talking through those things, but it is their right to sort of communicate their wishes and for you to be able to communicate clearly. Now, it's much better to do something like that so that they have full understanding of the severity of their injury or the severity of the situation. And it allows the whole team, plus the bystanders or the family, plus the patient, all to be aware of what your plan is. Does that sort of help?
Yeah, that definitely helps. I really love that and how you can apply it to pretty much everyone in every case in terms of communication. Yeah. It's the biggest part of what we do. And I guess then, like, if that's what you do in your, you know, your most stressful times, but then you also do it in your everyday times as well, at least then you've got some carryover in practice in what you need to do. Because the way you talk through it makes it sound like it's, you know, second nature and quite simple. And I guess I wanted to ask you in that sense, so did you go to births prior to doing your midwifery when you were a paramedic?
So, yeah, I went to, like, the majority of births that I've done as a in my paramedic career, working as a paramedic rather, were before I did my midwifery training. I've only done the last five births that I've done have been since I've been a midwife. And the others before that was when I had no midwifery training. So it was just the training that I got at university. And I was lucky enough to go through uni at a time when we got an obstetric placement. And so I think I got to see and help with, I think, three births during my hospital placement. And that was really helpful, but it gave me a very keen interest into learning more and realizing that it can be a high risk situation. Mm. So the more knowledge that I could gain and gather, the better. And, you know, so yeah, I guess for the majority of the births, I was flying a little bit blind, you know, without any, you know, specific training in that.
Other than, I guess, that specific training that you received as a midwife, what changed your perspective after doing your midwifery when you've gone to those five births since, compared to all the ones you did without your midwifery training?
Well, the first thing is I'm more stressed now because I've got more knowledge, and with more knowledge sometimes comes the the realization of some of the consequences. And also the, even though I'm not working as a midwife, I guess there's an expectation on me that I should be able to perform. But when I work as a midwife, I also have a team of midwives and obstetricians around me and a theatre that's available for emergency C-sections. So there is a little bit more stress, but I guess the main things that's changed is my appreciation for that the most important person in that room is the woman. And if I can't get buy-in from her, then it's not going to go well. If I can't build that trusting relationship quickly, then it's going to, I'm just going to be chasing my tail the whole time. And the other thing is the consent part. And that's come all the way over to everything else I do as a paramedic is, you know, especially as a male midwife, but all midwives are very good at getting consent and just working consent into a normal conversation. And, you know, consent isn't just asking, can I do this? It's the explanation as to why you want to do it and what the benefits are and what the alternatives are. And I notice with experienced midwives when they talk is they sort of just have a conversation which explains everything really in quite a beautiful way that we don't really do as paramedics. So now I guess when I'm talking to any patient, you know, gaining consent and trust plus providing information and opportunities for questions and alternatives is becoming a bit more second nature, which is changing the way that I look at my practice and the way that I reflect on my practice and also the way that I sort of expect others to practice as well, which is a difficult thing. But in terms of the births themselves, I guess I've been quite lucky. I have had quite a few emergency births or sort of birth complications rather as a paramedic, and you know, they've all gone quite well. I haven't really had any significant poor outcomes, and they definitely do occur pre-hospitally, but I guess now I'm just a little bit more understanding of my time frames, what needs to happen. Obviously my skill is a lot better and I can identify earlier when I need to intervene and also when I don't. And that's probably the biggest thing that's changed. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, definitely. Does answer my question. And I guess that's a really good experience. And I mean, if you were going back and telling your, you know, first day on the job self, you know, what would be one tip that you'd give to yourself regarding obstetrics?
God, that's a really good question. Well, first of all, I didn't think I'd ever actually become a midwife. Like that was just very left of field. I don't know where that came from, but it's, you know, I even when I told my parents, I was like, oh, so I'm going to go study midwifery. And my dad said to me, he goes, oh, that makes sense. I was like, oh, does it? It doesn't make sense to me. He goes, oh, you've been delivering, because I grew up on a farm. It's like, you've been delivering like baby animals since you were a kid. Like you've always been really interested. So yeah. And then, you know, so I went and did my midwifery, but what would I change? Probably my clinical things that I would change is that I would say put more emphasis on the delivery of the placenta because it's really important to prevent postpartum hemorrhages and to always make sure that the babies are warm. They're my two things that I probably, when I look back, I probably didn't really understand how significant they are. And then from a patient-centered focus would be trust is everything and consent is part of trust. And it's really important to do that trust building from the minute that you walk in the door. And when I do look back at some of my earlier births, I remember one very vividly because I was responding as a solo CCP. There was no other backup available and I went to a birth and I walked in the door and there was a woman who was obviously about to have a baby. She was pushing and she was lying on a living room floor. And I walked in and she said, where's everybody else? I said, well, do you want the good news or the bad news? And she said, oh, the good news. I'm like, I've done this before. She's like, what's the bad news? I was like, nobody else is coming.
Oh, no. Yeah.
So she goes, I'm not doing it here. And I was like, well, I don't think we're going to be able to get to the hospital. And she goes, no, I can't do it on this floor. I've just had the carpets redone. And she was actually a GP. So I think she knew the mess that was coming. So we, you know, part of that trust building, I said, okay, do you have any tarps? And in the end, we got some blankets and sheets and put them down. And that was one of her biggest barriers to not trusting me, but just trusting the environment and the situation, is that she really was did not want to. It was just her and I alone. Her husband wasn't there. She didn't want to birth alone, and she didn't want to get her brand new carpets dirty. So by mitigating that and saying to her, okay, well, you don't push, I'm going to go and find some stuff and we'll put it down, she was able to relax. And that was just one less fear. And it might seem a bit irrational to you and I, but you know, for her, that was transitional, and she was emotional, and she was vulnerable and alone and scared. You know, just taking that one extra 2 minutes, you know, to make that environment a little bit safer and a little bit better for her, was enough for her to really then just focus on the birth. And she had a job to do, and she pushed that baby out within, I don't know, maybe 20 minutes. And her and I were sitting there waiting for the ambulance to come. And she's like, I could probably just drive myself. I was like, no, it's okay, we'll just wait. And yeah, by the time we got to hospital, the baby was breastfeeding, but I did not deliver the placenta, which is, you know, very shameful of me now that I'm a midwife. But anyway, we learn.
No, that's a really cool story. And I guess too, it ties in nicely to that, you know, person-centered care. And one of the best tips that I got told recently, I asked a nurse at my work when I was just chatting to her about everyday things. She said, ask the person what they want. So we're talking about, you know, cultural safety and just person-centered care. And she said, just ask what that person needs and, you know, act on that. So everyone's different. You can't obviously know what every single person wants or needs, but just opening that question up, I thought was a really nice way of putting it.
Yeah, I think that's some really, really good advice, and something I wish I could have maybe incorporated things like that into my practice from an earlier age, and it would have made me a much better clinician, you know, much earlier. And just by allowing the person to say, I'm just scared, or I'm alone, or whatever, and you just responding saying, well, I'm here with you and I'm going to stay with you until, you know, we get to hospital, and then your husband or brother or whoever it might be will be able to be there with you and meet you at the hospital. You know, can really change the experience. And, you know, patient-centered care allows you to think about not just the care that you're providing, but also the experience that person will have. So, you know, as you develop your clinical maturity, your focus will be less on the care that you have to give, because your knowledge and intuition and experience will just guide you with that. But focusing on patient experience will just take you to that next level and saying, not only did I do a good job from a clinical perspective, I've left that patient in a better state than what I found them, not just physically, but also mentally and socially or whatever it might be. And that comes from asking those questions of what are your expectations, or what can I do for you right now to make this better? You know, can't fix a broken arm or an amputated leg. We can take some of that pain away. But if it's something like, I can't find my phone, you know, sometimes that just that one thing, if they've been in a car accident and they don't have their phone, it takes nothing for one of you, or, you know, get a student to go to the car and look for the phone, or, you know, ask for a fireman or something, say, can you please go and find the phone? Or the glasses, like people that lose their glasses. So I can see you wear glasses, I wear glasses and on contacts. If I was in a car accident and lost my glasses, I would not be able to see a thing, and I would be hysterical, you know. So just taking that time. And as a young paramedic, I didn't realize how important those little things were. You know, as we mature and age and clinically mature, you know, those things have a higher focus, and it's really important. And sometimes asking that question, what do you need or what do you want right now, just can take your clinical care to the next level.
Absolutely. I really like that. And that's something I've been thinking about lately in terms of, you know, the way that you treat someone or care for someone that is in your care. At the end of the day, like, you're shaping their view on how they'll interact and see healthcare in the future. Like, if you give them a poor experience, they probably won't be as willing to either call an ambulance again or go to hospital. Or so I thought, oh, like, with every person you meet, it doesn't matter, you know, who they are, what they've done, like, you will impact how they see healthcare in the future.
That's exactly right. So an unbiased approach to patient-centered care with a focus on patient experience.
What a good key takeaway.
Yeah.
Awesome.
You know, I've got a few little mantras that I usually use as funny things. It's like, you call, we haul. You know, that's one of them that I've always said, because, you know, leaving people at home, while it's appropriate sometimes, it comes with a lot of risks. And if you're not equipped with the knowledge and the experience to be able to mitigate those risks and be able to explain those risks appropriately, you know, then you're leaving yourself open for all sorts of problems and the patient. But my new mantra is, you call, we haul, but we'll do it with a smile, because we see so many complaints about attitude, and it's because we're all overworked and, you know, tired and hungry, but we just need to remember to smile and use that patient-centered, patient-focused, patient experience. You know, we're looking after one patient at a time. You know, we're not looking after a ward of eight, you know, so we need to just remind ourselves of that. That's hard to do.
No, I really like that. I guess we've gone through a bit about the attitude sort of perspective, communication, person-centered care, or patient-centered care, and a quick guide to physiological birth. Before I move on to the final three questions that we ask everyone, is there any sort of tips or anything you wanted to, other than the ones we've already highlighted, but anything that you think we've missed out on today that you'd really love to get across to students or graduates?
Oh, I think, you know, from being in my class well enough that I always have something to say, but I don't know. I think we kind of spoke about most things, you know, that I can really think of, but when it comes, especially with birth and obstetric emergencies, I think you just need to constantly refresh your memory, and, you know, just develop your knowledge a little bit so that you are prepared for that low frequency event, and you don't go in being avoidant or being nervous or anxious. No, I think anxiety is fine. I think our whole job is built on a certain level of anxiety, you know, and, you know, I call it stress inoculation, where, you know, with time, as we become more clinically mature, we become a little bit more comfortable with that anxiety and stress level. And, you know, with birth, it's difficult to build that inoculation because you don't go to them very frequently. And we're dealing with what could be a high risk situation. So the more knowledge you have will hopefully help with the lack of experience that we get.
I really love that one. And before I finalize on that as well, the one thing that you mentioned as well in that first week that stuck with me was, birth is normal. And I just keep thinking that. I'm like, okay, it's normal. We don't have to make it into an emergency if it's not one, like you said.
And the other one that, you know, this is, you know, it's a bit funny, but, you know, it's meant to be a little bit tongue-in-cheek, is that it will fit. Because I remember the first few births I went to, when I could just see the labia parting and I could see this big head behind it, and I was looking at myself, like thinking to myself, that's not going to fit, it's not going to fit, it's not going to fit. Providing time for each contraction and push, it stretches and it will fit. And it's pretty incredible to watch and to have that privilege of being there and supporting the woman with each push. But there's a few times in my first few births where I thought, well, I don't know how we're going to get out of here, because that baby is not coming out of there. That's, you know, and I do a lecture of the 10 things that midwives wish paramedics knew. And I think maybe some of you guys have seen that one at obstetric symposium maybe over a year ago now. And that's one of the 10 things that it will fit. And those contractions, when you're seeing that perineum bulging, that's designed to make everything stretch and allow that perineum time to stretch in the pelvic floor and everything to stretch around it. So yeah, don't stress, it will come.
And is the second one of that top 10 not taking pictures?
No, I didn't put that one in there. And that's, I mean, that's personal preference, I guess. And as long as it's done with consent, it's fine. But I think, you know, for anybody that builds that knowledge around birth and, you know, the important time of the baby being skin to skin for as long as possible after birth, then, you know, they'll realize, oh, actually, it's probably not the best thing to do.
We have a little bit of time as well.
Yep.
You just brought up that really thought of the 10 things that midwives want paramedics to know. What are a few of those?
Oh,
sorry to put you on the spot.
Yeah, no, I'm just trying to think of all of them. So I think it's about working with fear. So recognizing that fear from the clinician or fear in the woman will promote release of adrenaline, which is counteractive to oxytocin. And I call this the cavewoman birth. So if you think back to, say, cavewoman times, I don't know when that was, a long time ago, it's instinctive, you know, it's nature that if we get a huge adrenaline release, then labor will stall or it'll stop. And that's because a woman, you know, historically will go to a safe, quiet, calm environment like her cave, and she'll go there to birth. But if there's a threat that arrives, like a paramedic or a midwife or a saber-toothed tiger, she'll get a big release of adrenaline. Now, that adrenaline will stop the labor, so she has time to run away and find a different cave to be able to birth in a safe, calm, quiet environment. And we see that quite regularly where women present to the hospital and they are in labor, or they say that they've been in labor, and then we get there and their labor is stopped. And it's usually because of the bright lights and the midwives that are a bit grumpy. And we say, okay, well, you're good to go home, keep laboring at home, because we want to send them back to their cave where they're, you know, they will labor better at home. And then they'll get home, their oxytocin starts again, and then they'll birth at home. And then the paramedics say, oh, those stupid midwives don't know anything. You know, they sent her home. They didn't even realize she was in labor. But if we think about the physiology behind it, it all comes down to adrenaline, oxytocin, stress, all those things. And that's the cavewoman birth. Another one was it will fit. Just talking about the stretching of the perineum and what that looks like. And there's a lot of photos in that lecture showing the stretching, and, you know, it takes time and effort for that to happen. Another one's about third stage and the importance of giving oxytocin and realizing that you do need to deliver the placenta to prevent a PPH, because the placenta can basically just sit at the cervix will start to close, and then we can't get it out, and we'll have to go to theater to get it out. And behind that, you might end up with a big retroplacental hematoma. So they might end up with quite a catastrophic PPH if we don't get that placenta out. And also the importance of guarding the uterus to protect that from prolapsing. I think just the stages of labor and what each stage looks like and what's happening. So the shortening and the effacement and the dilation of the cervix in the first stage, transition stage, and then second stage being the obviously the delivery of the baby. Recognizing transition and what that is and what it looks like. I can't remember the rest.
No, that's awesome. I really like that. No, that's a new point as well when you mentioned that women need to sort of be in that safe environment. I really like that one as well. Talks to a lot of the things that you're talking about, building trust and making things safe.
I think that crosses over to everything that we do, like that rest and reassurance should be trust building. You know, like we don't provide rest and reassurance, we should be building trust, and part of that is reassuring the patient. And I don't think there's another time when it's more important than when we're dealing with a laboring woman, so that we can provide that cave to her where she feels safe, supported, and allow her body to do what it's built to do.
That's really cool. I really like that. So I guess now I'm going on to our final three questions, which are the ones that we ask every single person. These will get you thinking, hopefully. So the first one is, and we sort of touched on it, but it's not just related to obstetrics, it's just in general. What is one piece of advice that you'd give to a student?
Communication is key. That's the advice, but it's multifaceted. So communication, so that you can do all those things like build trust and talk to your patients or the people that you're dealing with every day, but also so that you can learn how to hand over effectively and how to advocate for your patients. The third thing about communication is that you can document appropriately and well, and being clear in your documentation, concise, but provides the information that's necessary. And probably the communication will then come down to so that you can be an educator, because we all have to educate students and our peers throughout some time. And there's never a time, oh, actually, and the other thing is the diagnosis is always in the history. So no matter what you do as a clinician, communication is key, because you will always find out what you need to know through communication, whether that's of getting information from bystanders or a witness at a scene or from the patient themselves. And just being able to communicate is everything in our job. So if that's something that anybody struggles with, you know, I think it's, you know, this is a good time, or you're a student, to really try to develop that. And it's not just being able to talk to patients, it's so much more. Like, communication is everything that we do.
That's a really good point, and that's something that's brought up quite a lot as a piece of advice to give to students, so that's really good. It's good to hear from different perspectives. The second one is, what's your biggest mistake that's resulted in your greatest learning?
Feeling overconfident. So as a new paramedic, and I call it the terrible twos, so second year student, second year ACP and second year CCP, that's when you're at the most confident at your level. So whether it's a student, ACP or CCP. And I think that's because your knowledge is still fresh and you are still learning, but your learning is not, you know, it's building on knowledge that you already have. So you're sort of adding to that, and you're probably starting to teach other people. And I remember as a second year ACP, I felt so confident that I thought I could be a CCP. And I became one with only 2 years of experience as an ACP. And that was one of my biggest mistakes. I should have taken more time to develop my practice. You know, and I had a lot of catching up to do as a CCP. So once I graduated from my CCP course, you know, I was with very little experience. And, you know, clinical decision making, I believe, comes from three different things, and that's experience, knowledge, and intuition. And so I didn't have much experience. My intuition was based on my previous life. You know, I was very young as well, but I'd traveled a lot and I'd spent a lot of time studying things like languages and things like that. So, and I went to university overseas. So I did have some intuition being able to read people, but my experience was low. So I really had to focus on my knowledge to be able to carry me through and to make big clinical decisions as the team leader for, you know, and with very experienced clinicians. And I guess, you know, I realized very soon the limitations that I had put on myself, and that's where I learned the most. Probably I didn't get my second year CCP cockiness. I didn't have those terrible twos because I was too busy trying to learn and build. And so it took me a little while to feel comfortable in my role. So, you know, I think, you know, as somebody that, you know, I just wanted to always be studying and learning and growing and pushing myself, I probably should have just slowed down, enjoyed being a clinician and taking the time to be the best clinician, because the more time you spend doing that, the better your patient outcomes will be.
That's a really cool one. Thank you for sharing it. That's really interesting. Yeah. I really like that one. No, that's good. So, the last one, and maybe it's similar to what you've already said before, but it is, what is something that you used to believe to be true that you no longer believe to be true?
I used to think that as a CCP, I had to be the clinical leader on every job, which meant I needed to know everything and needed to always be the lead. But what I've realized as I've gained clinical maturity is that a leader is somebody who empowers other clinicians to bring everything that they've got to a high risk or a stressful situation, and to develop that team approach is actually better than trying to lead by doing everything or trying to know everything. And I've realized that I definitely don't know everything. And you know, going back to those clinical decision-making, you know, of intuition, experience and knowledge, everybody has different levels of that. And over time, like my knowledge has probably dropped off a little bit and I can focus more on my intuition and experience. Whereas your knowledge might be really high because you're still studying, you're reading and you're doing things all the time. So I could ask, you know, during a situation, you know, what's your perspective? What do you think we can do here? And by communicating, like I said in the very beginning, you know, if I state my plan, you know, I expect everybody to have a voice. And if they don't agree with that because they know something that I might have forgotten or I don't know, that they will stand up and advocate for their patient. So I think that might be something I used to believe, but now I don't. Was that the question?
Yeah, that's cool.
Is that, you know, I don't need to be a leader by doing everything. To be a clinical leader or a leader of any team, you need to empower everybody and build trust and respect and give everybody the space to be able to communicate their thoughts. Sometimes you do need to be able to sort of cut them down or not cut them down, but sort of stop them short if it's not going in the right direction. And you need to be able to lead through empowering, saying, I really appreciate that, but I don't think that's going to work in this situation.
Awesome. Those are really good perspectives. And I can't thank you enough for, you know, making time out of your day to come on and share all of that with the listeners and myself. I've learned lots. I feel like I learned a heap too. So it's awesome.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, yeah, thank you so much. I'll sign it off there. Yeah, thank you for coming on.
No worries. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. You can connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or you can email us at studentparamedicpodcast@gmail.com.